This is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, early in May 1967. A month from now, 33 cars and drivers will compete in the annual Memorial Day 500-mile race. But now there are 91 cars and 61 drivers preparing for time trials. 2 weeks from now, the competition will be against the clock. Only the fastest will qualify for those 33 starting positions. Every Indianapolis car is a special, designed and built for championship racing. But this year, something really special rolled in. It was one car that couldn't leave the garage without drawing the crowd. This was the year of the Quiet Revolution. The STP turbo car monopolized attention wherever it went. Other drivers, other owners, the press, and the fans all understood that here was something really new. Distinctly new in appearance, with the driver and the engine sitting side by side. And most impressively, new in sound, with the flavor of the space age. Everyone wanted to know more about it. More pictures were taken, and more interviews recorded than anyone could remember happening before. Anthony Granatelli, president of the STP division of Studebaker Corporation, spent almost as much time answering questions as he did directing the STP team's preparation for time trials and the race. A new car, a revolutionary car, doesn't just happen. This was the culmination of 2 decades of racing experience for Andy and his brothers, Joe, president of Paxton Products, and Vince, chief mechanic of the STP racing team. 3 years of planning had gone into the development of a totally new chassis, but the project was stalled by lack of the right engine, until, as Andy put it,
I've learned that the United Aircraft of Canada turbine engine has all the things we need to fit our race car: acceleration, deacceleration, economy, things that are unknown, unheard of in turbine power.
Smooth operation and tremendous reliability are the primary features of the turbine engine. It operates by forcing heated expanding air through a turbine wheel, which turns the power shaft. There are few moving parts in a turbine, and they are critically balanced for precise, even rotation. Diesel oil, alcohol, even perfume could be used for fuel, but its normal diet is kerosene. The fuel is ignited by a unique device called a glow plug, a plug which was developed specifically for this turbine by Champion Spark Plug Company engineers in collaboration with United Aircraft of Canada. Unlike spark plugs and igniters for other engines, the glow plug's firing end has a coil that glows white hot to start fuel burning and provide dependable, continuous power.
Finally, the right engine. How do we harness all this torque? How do we make a car handle? The technician reports that we need a box section plane of aircraft design. The engine must hang out like a wing on an aircraft. The driver must hang alongside. This means centerline construction, wishbone backbone type.
Riveted under stress for maximum strength, the frame could stand an impact of 30 G's. Fuel is stored inside the frame in separate rubber-lined safety cells. Aerodynamic design of the body was developed through a series of wind tunnel tests of varying shapes. Special emphasis was placed on airflow beneath the car. A new shape called ellipse variant was arrived at and began to take form in fiberglass. Four-wheel drive means extra weight, but it also means vastly improved handling and far more efficient use of the engine's torque. Finally, the car was ready for its first public appearance. To drive it, Andy wanted 1963 Indianapolis winner Parnelli Jones.
First time that Andy asked me if I was interested in driving it, I felt at that time that the car would have lack of throttle response and lack of deacceleration. But I told him that I'd take a test ride in it in Phoenix and give him a good, honest evaluation of it. And of course, I didn't know if it was going to take off over the fence when I jumped on the accelerator. And I was really impressed, and I didn't even care about getting back in one of them other automobiles. And then I told him, I said, well, I've got to go to Indianapolis to take a ride in. So I did, and of course, it was raining at Indianapolis. The weather was very poor, and we didn't get very much running in, but I ran out in 62. And I said I certainly was going to be interested in driving the car.
The car had been built to conform exactly to the U.S. Auto Club rule book. All cars coming to Indianapolis receive a technical inspection by USAC officials, covering weight, geometry, quality of materials, and workmanship.
There, and we'll accept it. I also want to check the flap.
The flap, which acts like the dive brake on an airplane, was added at Parnelli's suggestion to assist the four-wheel disc brakes.
And the conditions out on the track. I want to compliment you on the design and structure of this chassis. This is one of the finest cars that has presented itself here at the Speedway in a good many years. And it's possibly the beginning of a new breed. You're to be congratulated.
As pleased as Andy was Byers Burlingame, president of Studebaker Corporation. The flap proved itself in track tests as the first order of business. Then the emphasis is on learning how the car handles in the turns. Fine-tuning the chassis. And adjusting the car to the driver. Four Lotus Fords also carry the STP colors. Colin Chapman, designer of the Lotus, is in charge of their preparation. Last year's 500 winner, Graham Hill of England, will drive one. 1965 Indianapolis winner, Jimmy Clark of Scotland, will drive another. And two are for backup. Other foreign drivers competing for the starting lineup are Jackie Stewart of Scotland, Dennis Holm of New Zealand, Joachim Lindt of Austria, and Lucien Bianchi from Belgium. As qualifying trials draw near, the pace quickens. It's a sleepless, hectic time. The teams are assisted by technical experts. Despite some gear problems due to a faulty piece of material, Parnelli pushes his speed up well into racing range. 164. 165. 166 miles per hour. It looks good. It's a happy crew that awaits qualifying trials. First day of qualifying. Drivers drew lots the night before, and Parnelli's turn is too far down the line for his number 40 to appear on the pylon. It will be a long wait.
I knew that the car wouldn't be an extreme qualifier because I knew that the other fellows could put the nitro and out horsepower quite badly.
With The nitro, high-energy nitromethane fuels used by piston engine cars, qualifying speeds were running very high. A record number qualify on the first day, and record speeds are reached. The minimum qualifying speed will prove to be 162.5 miles per hour. The maximum will come within an eye blink of 169. But Parnelli didn't do so badly. Using his normal fuel, his first lap speed was 166.482. Qualifying speed is the average of four laps. 166.482 again. 165.899. 165.441 for an average of 166.075. The turbo car qualified sixth in a field of 33. A few pushed too hard. Jim Clark makes it, but at a disappointing 163.213, slower than last year. Graham Hill, who's had his problems all month in number 80, switches to an untried car on the last day of time trials. If he doesn't make it, he'll be the first defending champion to fail to qualify. He makes it. He's in the last row, but he's in the race. In the front row were Gordon Johncock, Dan Gurney, and on the pole with top qualifying speed of 168.982, Mario Andretti. Parnelli wasn't too worried about his starting spot.
I felt that when the race started, when they took their nitro out, that their speeds would come right on down past mine.
Between qualifications and race day, the track is open for 3 short hours for carburation tests. 32 cars which used hotter fuels to qualify now readjust to racing fuels. Pit practice. Crews rehearse for those critical fuel stops. 2 are required by the rules, and the race can be won or lost in the pits. 3 STP specials and 3 Wagner Lockheed specials give Studebaker Corporation more cars in the lineup than any other sponsor. Memorial Day 1967 dawned overcast and damp. But gray or not, the time was at hand. The opportunity to test all that had gone into engine development, chassis design, and handling characteristics. After the traditional parade and pace laps, bringing the cars up to speed in starting order, the pace car pulls into the pits, and the race is off. Parnelli Jones makes his way high on the outside. Out of the groove, he takes Gurney. Now John Cox. Look.
I really didn't have the intentions of passing all them fellas, but they all started going to the groove. I'm sitting out there, I can't get down anyway unless I back off and follow 2 or 3 other automobiles there that were behind me, so I thought that I might as well go past 2 or 3 of them and see what the outcome is after I get out of the corner. It just seemed relatively easy. Of course, I was right there behind Andretti, and we actually came out of my 2 turn 2, and by the time we hit the straightaway and he moved out to the fence, it was just wide open for him.
And so, halfway through the first lap, Parnelli Jones has slammed his turbo car into first spot. Lap one is a track record for Jones and the turbo car, 154.374 miles an hour. It looked easy from there. The race became a battle for second place. Andretti, with a slipping clutch, loses second place to Dan Gurney. Foyt takes third. And soon Andretti is in the pits for an unscheduled stop. The clutch looks bad. Meanwhile, Parnelli has turned a lap at 164.9 miles per hour, faster by 6 miles an hour than any lap ever turned in a race at Indianapolis. And then, for the second time in Indianapolis history, completion of the race is postponed because of rain. A clear day for the restart with the cars in the order they were running when the red flag fell. More than half of yesterday's crowd is back to see the finish of this historic 500.
Restart your engine.
And another pace lap. Parnelli lost his 13-second lead on Dan Gurney because of the restart. Andretti's back with a new clutch, but he's 6 laps behind. And the race is on again. It looks like a repeat of yesterday's parade. Andretti pushes hard to make up those lost laps. Graham Hill, plagued with engine trouble, makes his second and last pit stop. He's out of the race. Jimmy Clark suffers the same fate. Up front, it's still Jones' race until, on his 51st lap, Leroy Yarbrough, following the normal groove for conventional cars, cuts in front of Parnelli, who deliberately spins to avoid a serious collision.
I thought that I really never lost control of the car during the spin.
With time lost on the spin, Jones loses the lead to Dan Gurney. Briefly. Then Gurney loses minutes in the pits with fuel valve trouble, putting A.J. Foyt in second spot. Andretti, moving up spectacularly, is in for misfortune. Parnelli uses the caution light when passing is forbidden to make a fuel stop. And the lead passes temporarily to Foyt. Parnelli, knowing Foyt will have to pit soon, sedately shaves the seconds off Foyt's lead. The strategy was simple. You've got to finish to win, so don't push the car. Just keep enough of a lead to give a clear-cut victory. Foyt pits, and the turbo car is leading again. Attrition is heavy, with many pit stops being permanent, and many stops outside the pits. That's Cale Yarbrough and Nell Kenyon. Avoiding them. Gordon Johncock loses a tire, leaving 17 cars running in the 195th lap. Traffic haters have been trickling out of the track, confident of the outcome. And others have lost interest too. But the outcome is not that certain. The turbo car is suddenly overdue down the main straight. On the 196th lap, with 7.5 miles to go, the car lost power to the wheels.
I was running quite smoothly there under the caution. I thought, there's nothing that can go wrong. It's like driving my passenger car down the highway. All of a sudden, it just went out, just like that.
And then, on the 200th lap... certain victory for Parnelli Jones of the SPP Turbo Car now became a third win at Indy for A.J. Foyt. The Turbo Car didn't win and its race was over, but the controversy it created had just begun. Within weeks after the race, decisions of the U.S. Auto Club would rule the car out of competition by changing the rules governing turbine engines. But at the moment, there was too much disappointment to look ahead. The cause of the failure was found, a defective ball bearing. Cost, $6.
I kept him slowed down all day long.
Did you make plans to run and any race?
Well, my dad said that to me a long time ago. He said, you can't get any darker after midnight, so I've already felt that many, many times, and I don't think I can feel any worse than I do, but I really feel sorry for Parnelli more than anything else.
Disappointed or not, there was no question about the big step they'd made in racing development. At a press conference called to protest the USAC decision, Andy, shaken, had this to say.
I built a legal car. I spent too much time and blood in it. What am I supposed to do now?
I can't sit here and die. I just don't see how I can do it.
Shirley Murphy, owner of A.J. Foyt's car.
As a car owner of a piston-engined car, which won the race only because the bearing went out of Andy's car, I don't think the turbine should be barred because Parnelli was able to drive that car and handle it on the track because of the four-wheel drive and the chassis construction and not because of the power that was in it.
Parnelli had some comments, too.
I'm the only individual that really could give an honest comparison. Nobody in USAC ever asked me how much advantage I really had, which I was a little disturbed about. And I think that if the other race drivers had the knowledge that I have from driving the car, they'd have a different outlook on it.
Colonel Gordon Cooper, astronaut and Indy race car owner, protests the USAC action.
And I believe this is a dangerous trend that we're establishing. This rule has just killed the turbine engine. It's a death blow to the turbine engine. And if we want to rule out progress, then... We've done it.
The car was quiet, but the sound and fury of the controversy it whistled into being was destined to echo through racing history for years to come.